skipping meals, living in a shelter, crashing on a friend's couch, many college students today are in all-out survival mode. A new survey of how college students are getting by casts a very large net. It reached 43,000 students at 66 colleges in 20 states. Sarah Goldrick Rabb is behind the survey. She founded the Wisconsin Hope Lab more than a decade ago at UW-Madison. The organization works to increase economic equity in higher education. She's a professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University in Philadelphia. The new report out this month is called Still Hungry and Homeless in College. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
And welcome back to Wisconsin.
I appreciate that.
So break down the numbers for us. How widespread is the problem of food and housing insecurity among college students?
Well, it appears to be very substantially widespread. You know, when we started looking at these issues, it was initially...
Are you there, Sarah?
Yes, I am.
Oh, it's a little bit... You're cutting out a little bit. Try again.
Okay. Can you hear me now? You sound good?
It's a little muffled, but keep going.
Okay. All right. So I apologize. So it seems to be very substantial. We have been looking at this issue for 10 years, as you said, and we look around the country at the nation's community colleges. We are also now looking at the public universities and some of the private institutions that have decided to allow us to do the surveys. We find a couple of different things. First of all, we find that at the community colleges, the rates of food and housing insecurity and even outright homelessness are quite substantial. We've done two different surveys on this, and the numbers range for food insecurity between somewhere just north of 40% to really, frankly, around 55 to 56%.
Where do you see this 55 to 60% going on?
Right. Well, the truth is that in the larger study that we did last year, which is 70 community colleges in 24 states, that's when we found those numbers. This year was a slightly smaller sample, and we found the slightly lower numbers. But again, it's not like it's concentrated in a particular geographic region. The only major contributor to these factors that we can find across schools are things like unemployment. It's really clear that students are trying to work during college, and when they can't, they fall short.
Can you explain what basic need security really is? Put it in plain language.
Yeah, I mean, what it really means is that students are having trouble making ends meet to the point that they're not getting their basic needs met. Those things like food and housing, they form the basis of Maslow's famous pyramid that says, if you want to do difficult things, if you want to do the kind of stuff you do in college, well, you really do have to be able to function cognitively. You have to be able to think. So food insecurity, for example, means a person can't get adequate access to good food, and they can't get it in a socially acceptable manner. So they can't go to the cafeteria. Some of them are dumpster diving for things like this.
So they don't have meal plans. There are dorms. They're not in a dorm. Where is this gap?
Yeah, well, first, only about 12% of undergraduates in the entire country live on campus in a dormitory. Secondly, it is perfectly possible to have a meal plan and have it be incredibly insufficient. These things are very expensive, and oftentimes students will buy maybe 10 to 15 meals a week in their meal plan. Well, I think the rest of us eat three meals a day and sometimes snacks in between, especially for people who are on the younger side. And so they will fall short for those other meals.
Food insecurity is not the same thing as hunger. These are two different issues here. So how much can we really know about whether students are going hungry or not?
They do overlap. So, for example, food insecurity at the lowest levels is often accompanied by sensations of hunger. But hunger is very subjective. Some people who have not eaten for a long time no longer, quote unquote, feel hungry, but they are not okay. They're not getting the energy they need to actually do what they need to do. That's why we focus on food insecurity, and it's not our focus. It's the focus of the U.S. Department of Agriculture and health researchers all around the world. The salient question is, are people getting what they need to be able to learn and to thrive?
Well, it puts colleges in a bit of a predicament as well, because if your study finds that students with meal plans are experiencing food insecurity, then it means that they're just not buying enough of a meal plan. Perhaps they're trying to find their food in other ways. What do colleges have to say on this end?
Look, I think most colleges in this country are in a very difficult position. The vast majority of them are public institutions who've had their budgets slashed by the state. And as a result, they can't raise tuition oftentimes, and I know Wisconsin's very well acquainted with that issue. So they have to find money somewhere. And many of them turn to what they call auxiliary enterprises, which are like things like food and housing, to try to make some money. They need some profit. And so when they raise those prices on things like meal plans, they think they're making the overall situation for students better. But the truth is they're not. And they're making that money on the backs of students. If they don't make that money, though, there's going to be fewer resources at the institution overall. So they're really trapped. And the real culprit here are those who've been defunding higher education.
We're talking with Sarah Goldrick Rabb about her new study. The report out this month is called Still Hungry and Homeless in College. She's a professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University. She founded the Wisconsin Hope Lab more than a decade ago at UW-Madison, and the organization works to increase economic equity in higher education. You can join in with your questions, your insights, your stories, 800-642-1234. Are you a college student or a grad student? What is your biggest challenge right now? Have you had financial challenges in school that you haven't experienced before, like having trouble affording food or a safe, stable housing? Do you worry that financial issues could get in the way of you completing your education? Are you a working student? How do you balance school and work? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah, are these problems that are present before college, developed during college, or are they exacerbated in college? Where does this start?
The truth is the answer is all of the above. Some people who are dealing with these things in college grew up in families with very little money. Many of them were receiving the free and reduced price lunch program when they were in school. But there are also people who I meet every day who never had financial challenges before college. They're paying the price of very substantial living expenses in college, and they're falling short of what they need for work hours. And as a result, they're not able to make ends meet while they're in school. They've never been through this before. They don't know what it means to go to a food pantry. They're deeply embarrassed, and many of them think they did something really wrong. And so the truth is, this is a highly diverse group of people who are dealing with it. Some of them look like they could be my children. Some of them look like they are, frankly, substantially older than even their faculty members. I'm meeting people who were 55 years old and trying to go to a community college to get a technical degree, and they're dealing with this while also raising their children and their grandchildren.
Let's take a look at Wisconsin in particular. How does our state compare nationally when it comes to food and housing insecurity among college students?
Well, we can speak to some of that issue, although I have to admit, Wisconsin's not one of the states that has agreed, you know, in a widespread way to really assess these challenges. We've done a lot of work, for example, over time with two outstanding institutions that have really been carefully looking at this, the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and Milwaukee Area Technical College, and we can see quite clearly that those institutions are grappling with these issues, and they might even be more severe than they are nationally, largely because the resources available both to those colleges and to those students are very, very thin. You know, if you take, for example, the UW-Milwaukee, the per student funding to that institution is many times smaller than it is to a place like UW-Madison. So as a result, the students pay a lot more money to go to school, and they're much more likely to fall prey to these challenges.
Are you finding that there are barriers to get access to students to take your survey that that has been difficult in getting in a foot on campus?
Yeah, there are two primary barriers to us being able to ask students these questions. The first barrier is that the college actually has to agree, because we need email addresses for students to send them the survey in the first place. So if a college really doesn't want to face this issue for any reason, then we're not going to have data on it. And that's really too bad. The other issue is that students, like everybody else, have limited time. And if I send them an electronic survey and I can't really pay them to take it, they're not going to take it in high rates. When we send these surveys out, about 9 out of 10 people delete them. And that's something your listeners should know. We are very upfront about the low response rates. But the fact is, we don't advertise this as a survey about food or housing, and we promise no help. So even when we don't reach every student, we should be thinking about who these people really represent. And I tend to think people who are really going through these challenges in a severe way are not spending time taking electronic surveys. So these are probably very conservative numbers.
What about the rising cost of living, of finding a place to live? You mentioned in your survey that a number of students out there are couch surfing, staying with friends.
Right. I mean, that is the most dominant form of youth homelessness in the United States. People tend to think, you know, you're only homeless if I see you on the street or you live in a shelter. But couch surfing can be very messy, and it absolutely means you don't have a home. For example, I've been working with a woman here in Philadelphia who's 35 years old and has a 9-year-old child. The two of them have been sleeping on a single couch together for more than a year. Nobody is getting the sleep that they need, and they're constantly afraid that they're going to be kicked out. Imagine how both she and her child feel each day when they're trying in the classroom to learn. That sort of stress undoubtedly undermines their academic performance.
Let's bring in a call now. Let's go to Kate joining us from Madison. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
Well, my question is, I want to know what's different today than in the past. And I say that because 45 years ago, I was in school at UW-Madison for 6 years, and I lived all of those 6 years on ramen, Kraft macaroni and cheese, peanut butter and jelly on white bread, and pretty much everyone I know lived like that. We crammed 5 people into a little apartment and tried to share the bills as best we could. Is it worse today than it was then?
Great question, Kate. Sarah, go ahead.
I couldn't hear Kate's question, unfortunately. If you could tell me what she asked, I'm happy
to
respond.
Sure. Yeah, she said, you know, 45 years ago, she lived on ramen and peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. It was fine. She went through UW-Madison in 6 years, crammed a number of people into a tiny apartment, and they made it work. What's different now?
Yeah, well, first, I'm really glad she got through. You know, that's a big challenge. And she's right that people have gone through this in the past. What is very different now are several things. Number one, the prices are so much higher, not only for tuition, but also for things like utilities, that what was possible for her to do is now harder. The second thing, though, is that a lot of the supports that were available when she went to college are no longer there. Some of those supports came from the colleges whose funding has been cut. Some of those supports came from policy. Things like food stamps these days are so much harder to get than they've been in the past. Students have to work at least 20 hours a week, and college doesn't count, and work is very hard to find. So unfortunately, those strategies that worked before often fail now. And one thing we should aim for is to get back to a time when doing what Kate did is a successful strategy.
We know that college tuition costs continue to rise, and campus meal plans, room and board, they're on the same trajectory. The new survey out this month from the Wisconsin Hope Lab found that college students around the country are having difficulty getting access to affordable food, that they're skipping meals, foregoing meal plans. We're talking about the findings with Sarah Goldrick-Rabb. She's a professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University, and she founded the Wisconsin Hope Lab. You can join in with your questions, your stories, 800-642-1234. Are you a college student or grad student? What is your biggest challenge right now? does this conversation about food insecurity and housing ring true? Does it resonate? Are you concerned about your own son or daughter having their basic necessities met on campus? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. The survey is called Still Hungry and Homeless in College. It was conducted by Temple University and the Wisconsin Hope Lab that is based on the UW-Madison campus. The survey found 36% of college students struggle to find enough to eat or have a safe place to live. We're exploring the findings on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Temple University sociologist Sarah Goldrick Rabb stays with us. She founded the Wisconsin Hope Lab. You can join in. Are you a working student? How do you balance school and work? Are you cutting out meals in order to stay in college and meet your expenses, meet your bills? Call in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's go to Bree now, who is waiting in Madison. Hi, Bree. Go ahead.
Hello. So I'm in my last year of my undergraduate right now. Throughout 4 years, trying to finish two majors, I have had to have four jobs at a time at the most and never had less than two. It's been really hard, and I do cut out meals quite often, especially when I have to pay for the utilities and the notoriously bad rent that comes from living in Madison. Luckily, I have really supportive parents that sometimes do help me out with food. And for 1 year, I did have to live at home and just commute an hour to Madison every day. But for a lot of people that I know, that's just not possible.
And Bree, why not take on more student loans during this time?
I've taken quite a bit of student loans on. Most of the time, it's more just the fear that I hear from a lot of people who are older than I am that I will be living with that debt the rest of my life. And so I've tried to take on as little as possible. Unfortunately, that isn't worth a lot, and I have taken out quite a few already because the burden of paying that much is just so high.
Mm. Sarah, what resonates about Bree's story here?
Well, it sounds very familiar. I studied students like Bree in Wisconsin for years and years. You know, I two things. I mean, first, most of these students are actually already taking loans. There are maximums to what they can borrow. It's not as if they can just get an unlimited amount of money. And, you know, I think a lot of people think of financial aid as a largesse, but don't realize, you know, the Pell Grant, for example, it's only about $5,000. And that number hasn't gone up for a very long time in a meaningful way. The other thing is, she mentioned family support, and I'm so glad that Bree has that. But many students don't. In fact, I found in Wisconsin that many students, instead of getting money from their families, they were helping support their families. They had to help keep the lights on for their parents and their younger siblings. And so, you know, that's really how this happens. They're very responsible, they're very caring, and they really do run short.
Bree, thank you so much for telling your story. Let's go to Michael now in Milwaukee. Michael, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Go ahead.
I am a retired faculty member at Milwaukee Area Technical College, and I run a economic emergency program affiliated with Sarah's Believe in Student, Inc. And I just wanted to shed some light on the situation of our students. We're the fourth poorest city in the country, and our students largely come from poverty. So when you talk about students getting help from their parents, that's largely not a reality for our students. Just last week, for example, we had three calls from homeless students, two who were living in their cars, and trying to attend college, one who was couch surfing. The issues that we deal with and that are huge issues, the biggest is housing. This year alone, we've worked with 83 students, and 31 of those cases have been either to prevent eviction or to help get a student into housing. Other problems that students face are things like car repairs. When you're running from school to work to trying to get your kids and your car breaks down and it's a 15 or 20-year-old car and it needs $900 or $1,200 worth of repairs, and without the car you can't function, that becomes an issue that affects your ability to succeed academically. Other issues that we've experienced when Sarah's talking about policy that I just wanted to mention are you have a situation where students are working maybe one or two jobs. They're in a health program, and they have to do clinicals in those health programs, so they end up having to give up paid work to do the clinicals, and then they can't pay their bills. We've had that situation emerge to come to us. And another is when students, and Sarah just referred to this, on the 150% rule. Just recently, two nursing students came to us. Both of them had gone to school, they were in their 40s. They had gone to school much earlier, gotten degrees, but had come back to become nurses. And now they've run out of eligibility for federal financial aid. So they were working, going to school, but the school was requiring them to buy a laptop that cost over $500, and they simply did not have that in their budget. So our fund helped them purchase that. But those are some of the kind of issues that students are struggling with. And again, I think people need to remember that many of the students, particularly in the technical college system, and there's 400,000 of them, are students who are working, their parents, and they're trying to go to school. And juggling all of those issues is very difficult.
Michael, thank you so much. Let's get Sarah to jump in here. Go ahead, Sarah.
Well, I mean, these are the stories, frankly, that the Wisconsin Hope Lab has seen for a very long time. And, that's why we continue to do research and look for solutions. When my book out of the Wisconsin Hope Lab, Paying the Price, was published, we decided to take any money that resulted from that book and put it directly towards the issues that Michael just discussed.
Sarah, you're fading out there. Can you get back on the mic?
Yes, I'm exactly here. Thank you. I said that we created the FAST Fund to try to help these students with these emergencies, and the demand has been very substantial to the point that when our book won a prize last year of $100,000, I donated the entire thing to the FAST Fund because we simply can't keep up. There are so many students out there facing this need. We're going to have to go beyond just these charitable impulses and create real policy change.
Something that people might not be thinking about, which Michael brought to light, are these clinical rotations that students in many programs have to take and have it be accessible at different hours for clinicals. And also, what about internships?
Yeah, these things are very real. You know, many internships for a long time were unpaid. Now, I should note that Great Lakes, for example, there in Madison, has acknowledged that unpaid internships present a real hardship for students. And they are funding now paid internships for students and helping places to offer them because they need the experience, but they can't go without the money.
Let's bring in Chris now, Chris now joining us from Adams. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. I actually read the Hope Lab's website, and I want to just thank you for the research that you're doing because it's really, really important. And I bought a house as an undergraduate, and I lost it because my student loans went into default. And I ended up homeless on the street. And I also wanted to suggest that people get a job. If you're going to work some dumb jobs, put yourself through college. Get a job in restaurants because then you have access to food. And people should also take advantage of things like food stamps, the food pantries. Madison has great resources. I went to UWM, and Milwaukee is horrible, but Madison has great resources, and the food pantries are wonderful. And if you go to the food, you go to all the food pantries in Madison, you can basically eat. What else was I going to say?
And Chris, you mentioned food pantries. Sarah, a number of colleges recently have been opening up food pantries. What do we see on this front?
Yeah, well, we see a lot of growth. I mean, if you go back 5 years, only about a dozen colleges around the country had them. Today, there are more than 565 colleges and universities that are part of the Food Bank Alliance nationally. You know, when I got to UW-Madison, we didn't have a food pantry. And for years, we said that we needed one. We fought very hard to get the one that is there now. And I'm glad that it's there, but you do need to know that food pantries have never solved food insecurity. They provide a modest amount of food in an emergency. We need proactive approaches instead. One program I'm studying in Houston now is called Food Scholarships. Those groceries, for example, are given to students up front and regularly so that they never experience food insecurity, and that's really important.
Well, we have heard before of the freshman 15 that students gain weight when they go to college. What would you say to that? Because oftentimes people say, you know what, there is an obesity epidemic and it's extending to our campuses.
Yeah, so what I think what a lot of people miss when they say that is that food insecurity is associated with obesity. Part of what happens with food insecurity is that you eat the cheapest thing you can find, which often is really bad for you. And this is one of the reasons people gain weight. It's one of the reasons that conditions like diabetes can be exacerbated. So this has health implications. And just because somebody's gaining weight does not mean, I think we all know this, does not mean they're okay.
Let's bring in Rebecca now in Madison. Rebecca, hi, go ahead.
Hey, this is Rebecca. I wanted to say, so I started college in 1998 at UW-Madison, and so it's 20 years ago now, and I also struggled pretty immensely with, you know, paying for college and housing and food, and eventually I went to UW-Whitewater and lived with my father in order to survive.
So, Rebecca, you just faded out there. Keep going.
Can you hear me now? Okay.
Yeah.
I remember keeping like $5 to $20 in my pocket at all times just to have that extra security to get food. And eventually I had to live with my father, and in my sophomore year of college at Whitewater, and had to pay for the utilities and groceries. And I did work at a restaurant on the weekends, and I did get a lot of food there, but I was one of four children and really struggled immensely, as we grew up in a really low socioeconomic status. So I struggled a lot from 1998 to 2002 paying for meals and housing.
What did you learn from that experience, Rebecca?
I think I learned, you know, just because you're going to go off to college and get this, you know, prominent degree and career, that it's still very hard. It didn't seem any easier than my fellow classmates that weren't going to college.
Rebecca, thank you so much for sharing that story. Sarah, you're a professor, and you put something in your syllabus that you started putting last year. It's a note to students. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, when I left Wisconsin-Madison and I began teaching at Temple University, you know, we're the public university of the city of Philadelphia. We have an incredibly high rate of child poverty in our city, a lot of segregation. And so a lot of the students in my classrooms, and I teach an introductory first-year class to mainly 18 and 19-year-olds, you know, we see these issues right up front. And so as I was starting to teach them, I thought, I need to let them know that if they're not okay, if they're dealing with food or housing insecurity, like your last caller, they shouldn't feel alone. They shouldn't feel ashamed. And we need to help them find the resources. And so I added a statement to the syllabus after the disability accommodations and the attendance policy that simply said, look, you know, if you're having difficulty with food or housing and it's affecting your academics, here's who you need to go see. I provided the name and number, and I further said, and if you feel comfortable letting me know about it, I want to know. And the reason for that is that in order to be an effective educator, we need to know our students. We cannot judge them. We cannot assume that because they're sleeping in class, they were at a football game. Sometimes they've just gotten off work or they didn't have a place to sleep the night before. That syllabus statement, after I tweeted it, spread all over the country, and more than 400 institutions now have adopted it. The next part, though, is that faculty need more support to know what to do when their students come to them.
Right, because so this item in your syllabus says, you know, they're urged to contact the dean of students for support. This will enable the dean of students to provide any resources that they may have. So what happens if they do reach out?
Well, so for example, at my institution, we have something called the CARE team, and it is very appropriately named because what it means is that we will proactively try to support you. It does not mean we will solve all your problems, and it does not mean we will pay all your bills. But we have an emergency fund. We have some access to additional resources for food and housing, and we will do what we can. Now, sometimes what that means is urging a student to keep on going and to keep advocating for themselves. And that's important because when you face these issues in college, it can be very easy to give up. You know, right now, the mindset of too many people is that college is a privilege, and if you can't hack it, you should leave and go work at McDonald's. But the fact is, nobody ever really made their way through college by working at a place like McDonald's. They'll never make enough money. We need them in college, and we need to let them know that we have their back.
The researchers surveyed 43,000 students at schools across the country, so a very wide swath. They asked students whether or not they identified with statements like, I couldn't afford to eat balanced meals, and I worried about whether my food would run out before I got the money to buy more. How would you respond to those students, to those statements? Temple University Higher Education Policy and Sociology Professor Sarah Goldrick-Rabb is with us. She founded the Wisconsin Hope Lab that produced the survey results that are out this month, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Does this conversation hit home? Are you struggling with having enough to eat as you go to college? Are you helping out a friend who's sleeping on your couch as they go to college? Call in, tweet us at WPR Mornings. We'll get back to the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Universities are accepting more low-income and first-generation students than ever before, even as tuition climbs steadily. A new study by Temple University and the Wisconsin Hope Lab suggests that students from low-income backgrounds, as well as those whose parents aren't U.S. citizens, may be less likely to regularly eat healthy meals, that food insecurity is even more of an issue. We're talking about the study on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Temple University sociologist Sarah Goldrick-Rabb is with us as we understand the depth of poverty on college campuses. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your biggest challenges right now if you're a college student or a grad student? Do you worry that financial issues could get in the way of completing your education? Call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Casey now, waiting in Madison. Casey, hi, good morning.
Hi there. I'm actually a student at UW-Madison, and I was wondering what I can do as a student or as a member of the community more generally suppose, recognize when other students are in trouble? And what can I do when I actually do know that?
Great questions, Casey. Sarah, what can be done?
Yeah, Casey, I'm so grateful that you asked, because the truth is that most of what's happening to address these issues in the country, they're coming from students. It's been student leadership. The first thing that you can do is, if you think a friend or a classmate is having these challenges, ask them. Ask them if they're okay and give them a place, you know, for them to tell you their story. It is so hard to feel invisible with regard to this issue. Another thing you can do is you can look at what students around the country have been doing on their campuses to improve the resources available. For example, there's a wonderful program called Swipe Out Hunger. This is a program where if students have extra meals on their meal plans at the end of the month, they can actually donate them so that other students can have them. You can be a powerful advocate for programs like that. And every year we host a conference called Real College. And it will be this fall in Philadelphia, September 29th and 30th. And we bring students all over the country together with policymakers and other leaders so that they can learn these things, bring them back to their campuses, and pay it forward.
Do you have any examples of universities you think are doing a really good job on this front in dealing with this problem, are thinking outside the box?
Absolutely. I think that the University of California system writ large, and same with the California state system, are both taking many, many steps in this direction. So let me give you one example. While food stamps may be available for some folks, a lot of students don't know how to get them. They're hosting benefits fairs on campuses, including on the weekends, so that people can assist students in signing up for programs. This is very cost effective because taxpayers have already funded these programs. And by drawing those dollars down to help keep people in college, they are growing not only graduation rates, but their local economy. At Amarillo College in the Panhandle of Texas, they have reoriented the job descriptions of every person who works at the college to say, we have no excuse but to recognize these issues and do our best to support them. They've grown their emergency aid fund. They've created an advocacy and resource center right in the center of campus where any student can get additional help when they need it. And they've generally said from the presidential level on down, we have nothing to be embarrassed about here. We are trying to create social mobility for students and for our community, and we're going to do whatever we can do.
So it's not a hush-hush issue. It's really bringing it out front and center and making sure that students have access, making it accessible.
That's right. I mean, for too long, we've acted like the only measure of a student's ability is their ability to pay. And, you know, I fought long and hard when I was at UW-Madison to get these issues on the institutional agenda. I think we met with some success, but there's a long way to go at most of our colleges and universities where they're more concerned with looking good and looking prestigious than they are about really meeting these students' needs so that they can get ahead.
Let's bring in Chris now in Marshfield. Hi, Chris.
Yeah, great topic. I got to say that I was a struggling college student at UW-Oshkosh and was working nights full-time, going to school full-time, and I made it through with the wonderful assistance of my classmates who, you know, volunteered to watch my kids on my work nights and then didn't charge me a dime. So, you know, Casey, who asked, what can you do? You know, it's person to person, reach out and do what you can to help people and give back when you have the means. And that's really, I think, more than any government program, that'll be what gets people through as those connections.
And Chris, I want to ask you how your experience in college as a single dad, how did that inform you? How did that shape you, that experience and that struggle?
Oh, my goodness. Going to the food pantry was the most embarrassing thing I ever did. I wanted to cry for a day after I got back because I wasn't man enough to provide for my kids. I had to go ask for that help. And so it motivated me to do whatever I took to get through that patch and be able to support my family.
Chris, thank you for telling your story. Sarah, there can be stigma here.
Yes, there really can be. And I mean, you can hear in his voice how hard that was for him. You know, one in four undergraduates today is a parent. 13% of undergraduates are single parents. Imagine what happens not only to them, but to their children if stigma prevents them from getting the help they need. You know, I want to mention one thing about what he said, though. So every day in this country, there are children in our elementary schools and high schools who need food. And one option when that need emerged was for them to turn to their fellow classmates and ask them to feed them, to share their lunches with them, for example, so they could eat. But imagine if we had done that rather than creating the National School Lunch Program so that every person who needs that support can get it without having to ask or depend on the kindness sometimes of strangers. Students feel very embarrassed to have to ask other people for that help. And so in many ways, while government is not the answer to everything, when a problem is this serious, sometimes it really is going to be the only viable long-term solution.
So you see extending the National School Lunch Program into the college area, college age?
I do, and I do because of the scope of the program, the scale of the need. And also, let's be honest, I mean, this is Wisconsin. Folks, agriculture benefits tremendously from the National School Lunch Program. There are a lot of wins here for people by expanding it at least to the nation's community colleges, because it is so important that the people trying to get ahead in those schools have the food they need so that they can learn.
Let's bring in Sarah now in St. Charles, Illinois. Sarah, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thank you so much for this conversation. It's really great.
You're welcome.
So I am a full-time student finishing my PhD in clinical psychology, and I'm a single parent, and I don't receive child support. So for me, working a full-time internship, being a single parent without that, I guess you'd say, safety net of another parent who can provide the excess that we need to survive. We're living on student loans and literally praying every day just to make it to the next day. It's seven more months of school and just robbing Peter to pay Paul every week, trying to figure out how I'm going to make it the next week. And I don't have the extra time to, my internship is unpaid, so I don't have extra time or hours to get even a job at McDonald's because I have my daughter, and it would literally cost me more money for childcare than it would, that I would make at work. So this is a crisis that really affects people of all ages and all situations.
Sarah, may I ask, in 7 months, do you see a job on the other side of this?
Yes, I'm guaranteed a position, thankfully, where I'm at right now. I just have to make it to the finish line. And my daughter, who's going to be seven at the end of this month, her and I always daydream about the exponential difference in our life when I finish school, going from a student with zero income and just living off student loans to being someone who all of a sudden is working in a actually clinical neuropsychology position is a drastic difference. I'll be blessed that hopefully the position I'll have will offset the cost of my education and the sacrifices that we have to make during this time. But then there's the factor, there's many people who go to college to get a degree that they're not even going to have that same income potential when they finish. So they're going to end up struggling for years after they finish their education as well.
Sarah, thank you for your story. Sarah Goldrick-Rapp, go ahead.
Well, I mean, if you hear the determination in her voice and the extent to which she's doing this with her daughter, then you can understand why it is that so many of us think it's a worthy investment to help make her life a little bit easier right now. You know, if she doesn't get to the finish line because the struggle gets to be too strong, and for many moms, that can happen. How many times can we go home and look at our child who doesn't have enough to eat and say, well, it'll be worth it in a few years when we finally make more money. It is extraordinarily stressful, and we do it on the backs of our children. And while some reach a positive outcome, many people, like Sarah, won't make it. They'll end up with no degree and deeply in debt, and they and their kids will suffer. And the thing about this is a preventable problem.
Do we have any firm numbers on graduation rates for students with basic needs and security?
Here's what we know. Look, I mean, people going through financial hardships in college, less than half of them finish college. And those rates are considerably reduced if you're dealing with housing insecurity or food insecurity. We can see people who are dropping out faster, getting lower grades. And even if they get their degrees, you have to wonder how much material they were actually able to take in, given the incredible amount of stress that they were under while they were in the classroom.
Let's bring in Therese joining us from Stevens Point. Hi, Therese.
Hi. Sarah, I really miss having you as a UW colleague. I teach at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point. The point I want to make is the food insecurity isn't just a problem of the campuses on big cities. It's also a problem even in little rural communities like mine. And I had a wake-up call a couple semesters ago when a student told me he hoped that the warm temperatures in the fall lasted a while because he was going fishing every day in order to feed himself. Our campus does have a food pantry, which is great, but I agree with you that this has got to start with policy change. And it's got to start with funding our public universities and those other institutions more. Thank you.
Therese, thank you for the call. Sarah Goldrick-Rabb, what changes do you see in the pipeline here, or what new projects or research are you looking toward next?
Look, I think you can hear in the description of this challenge that this is not only about financial aid. So when the Wisconsin Hope Lab closes this summer, which it will because we didn't receive the support we needed at the university, when we reopen this fall as the Hope Center for College Community and Justice in Philadelphia, we're going to be tackling this not only as a financial aid challenge, but also as a challenge of social policies interacting with higher education. So let me give you one example. I think a lot of people know that former foster youth are struggling more in college because that system essentially drops them off at the door of college without providing support. And I was actually really grateful to see the state of Wisconsin take some steps recently to try to help that population. But around the country, those folks are more likely to become homeless. And we're going to have to work not only on higher education policy, but also on the policies governing the foster care system to solve it. So I think that's where the solutions are going to lie. They're going to lie at the intersections of policy practice and also perception change so that people understand these problems and their complexity and understand them better so that they want to work on them.
Sarah, thanks so much for making time for us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I miss Wisconsin, too.
Sarah Goldrick-Rabb is a professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University. She founded the Wisconsin Hope Lab more than a decade ago at UW-Madison. It's moving to Philadelphia, as she said this summer. It works to advance economic equity in higher education. And the lab will be moving to Philly and reopening as the Hope Center for College, Community, and Justice. The new survey out from the lab is called Still Hungry and Homeless in College. This hour of the morning show was produced by Colleen Leahy and Brianne Shasso. Michelle Johnson is executive producer. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this conversation comes to you on the Ideas Network.